I find the fastest way to travel is by candlelight.
You've got a Babylon candle?
Yeah, I have a bubbling candle.
A Babylon candle.
That's what I said.
You said bubbling.
Welcome to another episode of Real Lit. I'm Steven.
And I'm Mackenzie. And it is just so great to be back here in front of the microphone. I'm super excited for the combination we have today.
Yeah, good book. And it's good to see you again.
Yes.
We were at a point there where we were seeing each other every day over the break. And now it's like we pass each other in the hall. And Right. Hey, that's about it.
And especially the fall semester, football and all the craziness. It seems like fast forwarding time.
It's been nuts. Essays coming in all of a sudden.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's almost like we have day jobs.
Yeah, right. And I'm really excited for today because we're setting our sights a bit higher than usual. After all, every podcast needs to shoot for the stars. So let's just hope we don't come crashing back to Earth.
Especially if it's from a stupid royal ruby. But seriously, today's podcast is going to be out of this world, so to speak. Today we're looking into the 1999 Neil Gaiman novel and the 2007 film Stardust.
Quite a stellar combination. We should probably stop with the bad celestial puns, do you think?
Never.
Never. Never no. Too many puns.
Never.
Agreed.
The worse, the better.
Glad we're on the same page. You know, last time when we talked about the Wonder Boys, the film and book are just so similar that it was almost like the same flow and narrative that we were discussing the entire time. But this time it's very different. You know, the film takes a lot more creative liberties based on the text.
It does. I mean, there are a lot of similarities at the same time, but there are major differences, particularly in the third act when it comes to plot. Mm-hmm. But tonally, right across the board, there's a big difference. The book is very much of kind of a dark fantasy, or it's still fairy tale-esque, but it's like Grimm's fairy tales. And if you've read the original Grimm's, you know they live up to their name. They are quite grim.
Absolutely.
The movie is very deliberately family-friendly and I guess there's a lighter tone to it. I don't know. Family friendly, but it's certainly younger. It's a PG-13 film.
Right.
Whereas I would say the book, to be fair, would be R if you were to shoot it just as a script.
Yes. And I do think that the film's ending is somewhat oversimplified. And granted, I understand the happy ending approach in film, especially when you are creating a film meant to appeal to a more diverse age group and kind of have that fairy tale ending that a lot of people want to see just for the emotion of it. I just think the complexity of some of the characters and their endings in the novel aren't represented in the film. Like the character development of Tristan, right? He's kind of a good guy in the entire film. Very idealistic.
Not the book.
And not the book. He's not in the book. Even changing his name from Tristran to Tristan, you know, and we'll call him Tristan for the sake of simplifying in vocabulary. But even changing that a little bit takes away from some of the symbolism that I'm going to talk about later that you see in the novel.
There's a lot with characterization. His mother jumped out to me in particular, Una. I like her a lot in the film. She's very sweet. You know, we feel sorry for her for being enslaved. And we do in the book, too, until she's finally let go. And she's just like, go be a king right now. It's all she wants is just like telling him, this is your sacred duty. Shoves him off. It's very cold.
Right.
Not that loving motherly figure that we see in the film.
No, yeah, and in the film, it is very happy ending. Like, I love you. I've always loved you. And in the book, we don't know that she felt that way.
Probably not. I mean, look at what she grew up with.
Right.
The brothers killing each other and the father laughing about it.
And also poor her a little bit. I mean, not that you should want to be murdered, but her brothers didn't even think about murdering her.
Well, it goes through the male heir, right? So they didn't have to worry about that. Until they changed it, but that's a whole thing we'll get to in the end.
Yeah.
The witches, very dark in the book. More played for almost comic relief in the film. I mean, Michelle Pfeiffer's scary at some moments.
Yes.
But nothing like what's going on in the book.
No, and the sisterly dynamic in the movie, I think, adds to a tone of humor that is also not present in the book. Kind of like a sibling banter almost in the film.
Yeah, and with the sort of slapstick nature like that, it almost takes away the sense of danger. I like this film a lot, and I know you did too, but I never really felt like our characters were like in that much peril.
Right.
Just, of course, it's a film. You know they're going to get out of it. But just there was never that real sense of suspense you get in a lot of other films, even if you know the good guys are going to live and be triumphant in the end.
Mm-hmm. And the ending, just the third act in general, it's the most different in the text versus the film.
It's that necessity to bring all of the plot threads together at one moment and tie them up all neatly. Yeah, they don't converge in that same way in the book at all.
No. And, you know, I think I prefer the separate timelines, really, the separate stories coming to their own conclusions in the book. But in a movie, I can see how that would be much more difficult, you know, for the director and for the actors. So I totally understand the practical reasons for that. And I understand the emotional reasons of wanting that overall happy ending for everybody. And the ending of the film has the knight in shining armor trope.
Pretty badly.
Pretty badly. You know, Tristan all of a sudden comes to rescue for everybody. And while the book does have several different conclusions happening at the same time, I like how in the book each character resolves a personal issue that was introduced in the beginning of the plot. And I like how Yvain continues to reign over Stormhold after Tristan's death. And we don't really get that in the film at all. We don't get kind of hint to that.
They go up into the stars with their bubbling candle.
Right. And so, you know, in the film, Tristan kind of comes in and saves the day for everyone. And that, again, just took away from some of the complexity that you see in different characters saving their own day.
I've got to ask you this, though. The ending of the book where Yvain comes to rule Stormhold.
Yes.
Did you take that as like a hint of sinisterness?
I mean,
like, I've got it pulled up right here. So Tristan dies and Yvain became the Lady of Stormhold. And proved a better monarch in peace and in war than any would have dared to hope. She did not age as her husband had aged, and her eyes remained as blue, her hair as golden white, and as a free citizen of the Stormhold would have occasional cause to discover, her temper as quick to flare as the night Tristan first encountered her in the glade beside the pool. So there's that little hint of that same temper coming out, but it almost seems like, you know, you got knocked out of heaven, you got stuck with this guy, let's face it, as a putz. But you got eternal rule over this Stormhold, at least. So there's, I don't know, am I wrong in saying there's almost, the word sinister came to my mind.
I mean, honestly, one of my first questions was, why did you want to stay? You know, I understand falling in love with this man and reigning with this man, but at first she was so angry with the fact that she was stuck on Earth at all. And so I was like, did that just disappear over time? Or is it that newfound lust for power that...
Yeah, I get the sense she can't go home in the book. There's just no possible way to do it, whereas they use the Babylon candle in the film. But it just seems like, I guess, if I can't be back to the stars, at least I can rule with an iron fist over all these peasants beneath me.
Yeah, I mean, immortality, you know. And it says that she was the best ruler in peace and war.
Right.
So I anticipate she's some kind of force.
Yeah, but that whole temper thing just makes me stop and go,
Absolutely.
Would you want a ruler whose temper flared like that?
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe not.
Yeah, they probably had a better balance together. And when I was thinking about the characters, looking into the characters, you know, we have some unique names in the book. And I was like, as a literary person, typically everything you do has a purpose in your writing. And so for my close read of the novel, I wanted to deep dive into the potential symbolism of names and modifiers in the novel. I believe there are multiple points of analysis for these names, but I jotted down my initial thoughts and then did some research to try and form a coherent analysis of the meanings of names in the novel based on the author and literary context or history that we've just kind of developed over time from reading. In most all literature, names carry significant symbolic weight, often reflecting deeper aspects of the character's identities as well as overall thematic concepts. I just don't think we can help ourselves as writers, honestly. There always needs to be a deeper, nuanced meaning to everything. I mean, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Both of us are unpublished creative writers, right? So
I'm going to use a number, if I'm going to have a street name, you know, it has to mean
everything.
Something.
How many times do you Google name meaning?
So many times.
All the time.
So many times.
We're on parenting websites. I have no children.
Absolutely. And so I tried not to search while I was reading. I tried to create my own like initial thoughts based on knowledge I already have and then went into researching. And I feel like I need to start out with our main protagonist, and that's Tristan Thorne. The name in the novel, which is Tristran.
Like Tristan, but with an R? That's the best way I can think of it. I don't know.
Just randomly placed in there. And Tristran is an unusual version of the more familiar Tristan, and they use that in the film. often associated with the tragic hero of the medieval tale, Tristan or Tristram and Isolde, which is one of my favorites.
Good one.
I personally love Gottfried's version of this tale. And similarly to the original tale of Tristan, the plot of Stardust alludes to Tristan's journey of love and his growth from a boy into a man. The name hints at the challenges he'll face, including the complexities of love and self-discovery, particularly for literary scholars who have been exposed to different versions of Tristan and Isolde. The surname Thorn could be symbolic of the obstacles or difficulties. It makes me think of our phrase, a thorn in my side, you know, and I know that that's more cultural to particularly Southern America. However, I lean myself more towards the interpretation that it also suggests his connection to nature and the magical land of fairy. It's just less obvious, so I like to think it's a form of nature imagery connected to the characterization. And then going into fairy, dearest Yvain, I love Yvain. I knew I had heard this name before, and after some searching, I read that the name Yvain has origins in Old French, the name Vain, who was a knight in Arthurian literature and legends. So I'm pretty sure I had read this name in one of my medieval courses. And although Yvain is a celestial being, contrasting the idea of a mortal knight, as a celestial character, she symbolizes light, purity, and immortality. However, knights are often associated with the sentiment of sacrifice. And Yvain displays this in her character as well. Also, as a knight is to his king and to his kin and fellow knights, she becomes like Tristan's moral and emotional compass, symbolizing the inner light of truth and self-awareness in Tristan, you know, even if she has a little bit of a blunt way about it. She does really try to force Tristan to be truthful with himself. And then we've got the other leading lady, Victoria, whom I am not fond of.
Oh, come on.
Not fond. And Victoria is derived from the Latin word victoria, meaning victory or conqueror. And so that's just something that I remember when I was reading from some Roman, particularly like Greek and Roman literature. Early in the story, Tristan is infatuated with Victoria, viewing her as this prize of his journey, a distant ideal to be won through only the grandest possible gesture, right? What's the grandest gesture I can do to have victory for this woman? And her name reflects how Tristan initially sees her, and that's just as a challenge, I think, as a challenge to be conquered. Then we have all our little mini-antagonists. Most apparently, the names of the seven lords of Stormhold are based on their birth order. We have Primus, who's first, Secundus, who's second, Tertius, third, Quartus, fourth, Quintus, fifth, Sextus, sixth, and Septimus, seventh. And so this numerical naming system is symbolic of their order in power and succession, truly a testament to an almost inescapable fate. I think. I mean, what kind of parents do you have to be to literally name your kids in their order? And it ultimately drives them to be murderers, is this idea of hierarchy. The names emphasize their singular focus on the hierarchy, stripping them of any individuality. And if I read deeper into it, I do think that Septimus's name, meaning seventh, reflects his determination to be the sole survivor and heir, not only as the last son, but also as number seven, representative of this idea of completion. Like, I am the complete one. I have everything you need in a leader.
And the one sister, just to throw it out there, Una, is the feminized version of unum, which is the Latin word for one.
One. Just one girl. One sister. I wish we knew how she was separated.
Yeah, we never get that story.
Yeah, we never know how she becomes enslaved.
We need a prequel.
Yeah, and why isn't the king searching? You know, for his one and only daughter.
The woman can't take the throne, so who cares?
Oh, a shame.
One less to kill if she could.
But she does get to meet various people, and when she meets Dunstan, I guess it's just this automatic connection, really, is what we gather from both the book and the film. And with the name Dunstan, I honestly had almost no initial thought behind any symbolism by Gaiman in this name. So after some reading, I found that the name Dunstan is of Anglo-Saxon origin, meaning dark stone or hill of stones. Not only does Dunstan live by and defy the infamous wall, but Dunstan also serves as a bridge between the human realm and the magical world of fairy through his consummation and birth of his son with a fairy princess. And so he is like a bridge, like a stone wall connecting the two. His encounter with the fairy market foreshadows Tristan's own journey, right? We see a big generational parallel, I think multiple, really, in the book and the film, but theirs is the most obvious. And his surname, Thorne, shared with his son, could reflect the shared trials that both will face when crossing into fairy, or the same connection to the land that I see in Tristan. And the name Stormhold is probably the most striking in the story. I love it. I love a dramatic name. And rightfully so, I guess, because it is the royal family. If you break down the name into literally storm and hold, it reflects the conflict and power struggles that dominate the royal family. You know, the storm part of the name evokes chaos, danger, and the violent power struggles among the brothers in particular. And hold implies a place of security or fortification, like a stronghold. Yet within its boundaries, there's so much betrayal and murder going on within that stronghold, a storm of chaos. Symbolically, the name mirrors the chaotic nature of a magical world, in contrast with the constant fight for control over it. And of course, we have to dive into our main antagonist after talking about our little royal antagonist, which is the Lilim, or witches, more commonly, I think, referred to especially in the film as the witches. Really, any name that begins with Lilla in any way makes my literary brain go to the predominant figure of Lilith as an ancient form of witchcraft, darkness, and evil. You know, the name Lilith has become synonymous with evil characters, and particularly demons, something that's demonic. The Lilim don't only phonetically represent this characterization, but they are ancient witches who consume the hearts of stars to regain their youth and power. So yeah. Evil people.
You think?
Not great. I mean, anytime we see the heart, you know, we know that that's something intense. And so like Lilith, they seek to reverse the natural order of the world, of the land, of life. And anyone who seeks to reverse natural order of life ends up coming into their own peril. And finally, I absolutely love the town's name, that it is Wall. So simple. I feel like it is a really great choice by Gaiman. It's simple but purposeful. You know, the town of Wall is named after the literal wall that separates the human world from fairy. Not only is it a physical divide, but also symbolically reflects the boundary between the known and the unknown, reality and fantasy, fate, the concept of fate always being decided, and then that concept of adventure in that you can make your own path. And so Tristan must literally cross the wall to truly begin his journey from boy to man. And the name also suggests a barrier that must be overcome for personal growth. A common saying that we use now is that we build up walls that often prevent us from some form of self-improvement. And so each name, carefully chosen by Gaiman, adds diverse meanings to the narrative, supplementing the reader's understanding of the characters and their purpose, not only in the story, but also to their internal conflicts, I think.
Yeah, names are very important. They mean a lot. And when we get into film, we have other visual aspects that mm-hmm. we bring to the table, right? So for my close read, first of all, I have to give a nod to our illustrious colleague, Brenna, who some of you will remember from our Birds episode. Brenna spent the past few years researching film costumes, an aspect of mise-en-scene that I usually overlook. But thanks to her influence, I suppose, I paid much closer attention to the costumes in Stardust, and I realized they make for perfect close-read fodder. So on this rewatch, I noticed a clever detail. Secundus's jacket features a Roman numeral 2, which gave me a little chuckle. But that detail made me look more closely at the other princes of Stormhold, or at least the ones who were still alive at first. Sure enough, Tertius had the Roman numeral 3s down the placket of his coat, while Primus's jacket had gold Roman numeral 1s overlaid on the purple fabric. And I couldn't get a clear view of Quartus or Sextus, the ghosts, though I suspect there are symbols there. But I can tell you Quintus's nightgown has diamond shapes all over the chest, which are V's, right, Roman numeral 5s, both upside down and right side up. It's a clever visual gag, but it also reflects their obsession with status and lineage. You know, their fixation on birth order is literally woven into their clothing, not just their names. And while it's not strictly a costuming detail, I just have to throw out a couple other points. I noticed that when Lamia, which is what we call the witch, Michelle Pfeiffer's character in the film, when she comes up behind Primus and gives him the Clytemnestra to his Agamemnon treatment, some of you will get that, his blood is literally blue. And another little bit of interesting trivia showed just how dedicated the filmmakers were to this theme. Septimus's musical score, when he's on the screen, is written in a 7/8 time signature. I know very little about music. I looked it up. I know that Rush's Tom Sawyer is in 7/8, so who knows? Apparently it's a very rare time signature, so.
I love that detail.
Something that musically inclined people will notice, I'm sure. Then there's Captain Shakespeare, who I'm going to spend most of the time talking about. Yeah, we love him.
He's I love that guy.
Probably the most notable character concerned with wardrobe in the film. And again, his costumes, both the ones he wears in public and the ones in private, reflect the dual layers of his own persona. The pirate's outfit is very masculine. It's deliberately a blue shirt. The petticoat and the dress have pink on them very deliberately, even though they're mostly white. His choice of clothing then becomes a visual metaphor for the dual nature of his character. He's both the blustering captain persona, which is a kind of armor to conceal his more tender, creative self. This dichotomy in his wardrobe plays into the theme of how identity can be both manifold and fluid. But Shakespeare's costumes blur the line between performance and reality. They show that identity, particularly gender, can be something that's performed, tailored, and layered, much like his wardrobe himself. Yes, I've read Judith Butler. The flamboyance of his private garb hints at his theatricality, suggesting both the hyper-masculine captain and the cross-dressing performer are roles that he simply adopts depending on the circumstances. And this aligns with the film's broader themes of transformation and self-discovery, where clothing is more than just a mere decoration, but more so a way to explore the fluidity of identity. Captain Shakespeare, as you remember, outfits both Tristan and Yvain, right, once they get on his ship. And he's not simply giving them new clothes. He's providing them with the visual symbols of their own evolving identities. By this point in the story, both characters are already undergoing internal transformations. Tristan is moving from this awkward, lovesick boy into a confident adventurer. And Yvain is gone from this sort of distant celestial being to a person who's capable of true love and actual vulnerability. Shakespeare's act of clothing them is almost like a ritual, marking that moment where their new identities begin to show outwardly. The clothes that Shakespeare gives Tristan are very dissimilar from the threadbare, ill-fitting outfit that he wears at the start of his journey. The new ensemble is one of a confident, dashing adventurer, and it visually aligns with the persona he's growing into. Captain Shakespeare's wardrobe choice suggests a keen awareness of who Tristan is becoming, even before Tristan fully understands it in himself. And Shakespeare is very perceptive like that. He also leans in and whispers that the one you love is right in front of you in his ear, you know, that we later find out revealed. So he already knows that that's there as well. As far as Yvain, her new outfit is equally transformative. When she first falls, she's wearing this shimmering silver dress, which is, you know, that makes perfect sense. She's a celestial being. After she takes the bath at the end, the trap, of course, is set by Lamia, and she's wearing a bathrobe, which is what she has on when Shakespeare's crew picks them up. The tattered robe is just a simple garment meant to simply cover one's nakedness, and it points to her vulnerability at that moment, because she's arguably in that inn with Lamia in the most danger she's going to be in the entire film. Shakespeare, of course, gives her a blue dress, which helps ground her identity in the human world. The flowing, elegant dress, it not only mirrors her inner transformation from an ethereal, aloof star to a figure who embodies love and emotion, but it also signals her readiness to fully inhabit the world around her. It is, however, worth noting, of course, that the dress is still dark blue, which, dare I say, is the color of the night sky, kind of still linking her to that place that she comes from. But the very fact that Shakespeare, with his own fluid identity, is the one to outfit her in this way suggests he understands the importance of her embracing her true self as well, just like he does with Tristan. So, deliberate or not, it's fitting that this is all done by the man who chose to call himself Shakespeare. Again, to evoke the duality, as he explains to Tristan and Yvain, it's an allusion to the bard, but also a name that his probably less well-read pirates might think means to shake a spear, right. Something very masculine and tough. The moment the captain dresses them, it's a theatrical rite of passage. Just as actors put on costumes to inhabit different roles, Tristan and Yvain don these new clothes to fully step into their new selves. Shakespeare, with his flair for the dramatic and his own identity shifts, presides over this costume change as both a director and a costume designer of their transformation, which reinforces the idea in Stardust that clothing is more than mere fabric, but it's a form of storytelling, a way to announce to the world and to the characters themselves who they are now.
And I do love costuming in any period before 2000. You know, there's something so fascinating about it every time you watch a film, because we don't dress that way anymore. And just thinking about how it fits to their character and fits to the period.
Yeah, I love period pieces anyway.
Yeah.
And that whole dressing is part of it. I've never paid so much attention as I have lately, though. Thank you, Brenna.
Yes, thank you, Brenna, for the insights. And so now we should take a moment for our advertisement from our sponsor.
Are you tired from chasing after fallen stars, evading sky pirates, or just looking for a cozy spot after a stroll through the marketplace? Then make your way to The Slaughtered Prince, Wall's finest establishment for hearty food, strong drink, and questionable company.
Situated just a stone's throw away from the market, we cater to all manner of travelers. Whether you're a hopeful romantic seeking a gift for your would-be fiancé, or perhaps a cursed witch in need of a drink after a long day in the Vardo. Yes, we see you, Sal.
Our tavern boasts the finest selection of drinks this side of Stormhold, with our famous Primus Punch and Septimus Ale, guaranteed to make you feel royally buzzed. Need a place to rest those weary bones? Rent one of our rooms. Modest, yes, but comfortable enough for one. Or two, if you happen to be concealing a star on the run. And don't worry, the curtains are enchanted with an anti-candle flame spell, just in case you need to bubbling candle yourself out of there.
Babylon.
That's what I said.
Psst. Planning to take a shortcut through the wall after a bit too much revelry? Not to worry. Our tavern comes with unofficial guides who know their way around the market's, shall we say, peculiarities.
So next time you find yourself in Wall, make the Slaughtered Prince your first and possibly last stop.
The Slaughtered Prince,
where stories start, secrets stay, and stars shine until they pay their tab. Did you know a bit of trivia, by the way, on the mural in front of the Slaughtered Prince in the film? The victorious prince, you know, is standing over the one who's been killed.
Mm-hmm.
That's the face of Peter O'Toole, the actor who plays the father.
I did not notice that.
Yeah, really cool.
But I would like to point out the Slaughtered Prince is not so subtle. Bar name.
Not at all.
No.
But it does.
But I appreciate it.
It's got that sort of sense of the naming of an English pub, though. It makes sense. I could see being in a small, remote town in England and seeing the Slaughtered Prince there go and have a pint.
Yes. And so I guess we should move into one of my favorites.
You love this one.
I love Most Hated Character. I like it because it's almost like putting all the characters on their own little trial. And of course, there are many characters that have some negative, you know, qualities.
You think?
I mean, we have multiple mass murderers. So I'll focus more on the personality nuances. In the film, I really dislike Victoria. I mean, I dislike her anyway, but especially in the film.
It's worse in the film.
She is so obviously leading Tristan on in the film, and I just really hate that disrespect. Though, if there is someone that is just on my nerves the whole time, it is Septimus, because he is such a hypocrite and so entitled. And so, I mean, he's kind of like Victoria on an extreme level. I understand that age doesn't automatically make his older brothers more capable a king than him. But there is absolutely no reason to so passionately want to kill all of your kin. I mean, for power that you just think you deserve, then get mad when someone else kills the brother that you were going to murder anyway. Like, what? His hypocrisy just gets me.
Yeah.
And he also burns a book of poems, so yeah.
No.
Not my favorite person.
You don't burn books.
I know!
I concur. The book and the film are both populated with truly unlikable characters. And I do have to say that one of the reasons I appreciate the book, and I know we say this every single episode, don't we? But the so-called good guys, we'll put that in air quotes, are morally ambiguous at best, right? When Tristan catches Yvain in both iterations, he's just like, yeah, I'm taking you with me. Never mind, you're a sentient being. But at least in the film, he makes the promise that he'll use the rest of the Babylon candle to get her home.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, he's just like, oh, you got a wounded leg, boo-hoo, start walking.
Right.
Just, at least in the film, he's somewhat considerate and not completely, solely serving his own self-interests. In the book, I'm not even sure why Yvain falls in love with him, to be honest.
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just proximity.
Maybe so. You were the first human I saw after I fell out of the sky.
Yeah.
Plus, he's a moron. You can see it in both, but it's so much worse in the book. Like, at least in the film, he does become heroic. But in the book, like, every single jam he gets into and gets himself out of, it's either dumb luck or it's another person or it's an object that's given to him. It's always somebody else bailing him out.
Yeah, and he's much more princely in the film.
Doesn't he, like, he has that one pointed ear in the book?
Yes.
Right? But he can't figure out that he's half fairy. And you're running around this realm called fairy with a bunch of people with pointed ears.
And he's the protagonist, and so immediately from the beginning, I want to root for him so badly. And I do, you know, because I don't want any of the brothers to become king, and I want a family reunited. But he just does little things that I'm like, really? Our hero's going to do that? You know?
He's a putz. I don't like him.
And in the film, he's Prince Charming. I mean, really, the whole time.
He's a good guy for the most part. He does wrap that silver chain around her right off the bat. But after that, seems to be pretty decent.
But he is much more respectful during that encounter.
Yeah.
In the film.
In the book, he's so rude.
He is.
Well, we know what time it is now.
It is. On to our academic style. We do enjoy, teach, and scholarship. And when we start with enjoy, and I love that we start with enjoy, because I love both. I will say there are some aspects that come off as cliche, you know, and a lot of that has to do with that this was written 25 years ago, and we've had a lot of fairy tale things come out since then. But we also need cliches, like the fairy tale ending every now and then. Honestly, I love a double world narrative, so I may be a little biased in how much I enjoyed both mediums. I really enjoyed the film's camera angles and lighting. I honestly just felt it was so aesthetically pleasing to watch. I think the costuming and set design are also so intricate, and everything seemed so cohesive with the narrative. It was truly representative of a lot of the plot that was going on and subconscious feelings that we as viewers get from aspects of the fabric, colors of objects. I hadn't read this novel before, but I had read Coraline by Gaiman.
Good one too.
It is very good. And so entering a fairy tale written by Gaiman was a code switch for me. However, there are still gothic tropes in Stardust, with supernatural elements and sort of this concept of insanity within the royal family.
I never thought of that. That's a good point.
I honestly think that humans are drawn to the fantastic and the magical. And so I went into reading this with the expectation to like it. And I thought the duality of the worlds was done very well thematically without it becoming cliche. And I would like to, I talk about the colors here, and something I didn't mention earlier was that the jewel of the king is topaz in the book, and it's a ruby in the film. And the only thing I can rack my head around as to why that is because a ruby is so distinct. It's red, the color of blood, and it's just so aesthetically shocking, maybe?
I don't know. It looked good on screen.
Yeah, right. It looked pretty.
You know, I think I liked the book and the film both more than I should have. There's some issues with the book. Specifically, you know, the drop narrative threads. We kind of mentioned the hairy, furry plot device guy. And there's some threads that just don't come to as satisfying as of a conclusion, I guess, as they could have. Like, you know, Septimus just very quickly and unceremoniously gets dispatched by the witch. And I do understand why, speaking of which, the defeat of the witch queen by Yvain had to be the way it was. It made good sense for the story itself, but it's also kind of lame. You know, Yvain's just like, you can't have my heart now. Tristram has it. It's a bit anticlimactic, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, we didn't get a big fight scene.
No, not at all in the book.
Not at all in the book. And I feel like that's the typical climax that we're looking for. So by the end, when you don't get it, you're kind of like, where was it?
Speaking of which, the film goes in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
And it pushes all the narrative threads into a very neat confluence that allows it all to be tied up. And there's this very stereotypical third act showdown. Of course, you've already mentioned the happily ever after. To be fair, that works. As we've said before, we'll give it some leeway because it's a fairy tale, right? And we expect those cliches. It just feels so contrived. And I understand that I'm criticizing the book and the film for doing the exact opposite thing, so pick one. But I just think there needs to be a happy medium in the middle. That said, I adore them both. Maybe it's the world building or just the strange details, like the princess's names or the ghost still hanging around until one's crowned. Maybe it's just the immersion of the magical world in general, but all I know is I didn't want the book or the film to end. Gaiman has said that he would like to go back, and if not make a sequel, at least revisit the setting of Wall and the Land of Faerie, and I'm all for it.
Me too.
I'd go there.
Absolutely.
As for teaching, there's enough to be mined from the novel to bring into the classroom. As a matter of fact, in my Brit Lit 2 class, I think I've talked about this before, but I always assign one novel. We've read everything from Frankenstein to Dracula to The Woman in Black, wink, wink. And just to show I'm totally not obsessed with horror, we last semester read Graham Greene's The End of the Affair. Each time, however, Stardust has made that short list before I choose. And our book orders are coming up next week, aren't they?
They are. So
I'll have to make this pick yet again. We will see. But one of these days, I do think it's going to make it. If, more likely, when I do finally assign it, I would like to show the film, too. Problem's just there's already so much little time to cover. I mean, we're going from the late 18th century to the present day across the entire UK and the former Commonwealth, which is a pretty hefty undertaking. I don't know that I could sacrifice the days to show a film, but I do think it would make for an interesting comparison. We both know that whether it's elementary school or university, students do love a good movie day.
Absolutely. And I certainly think this novel could be effective in the classroom. I think of how often we teach Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, you know, even at the middle school level, high school level, college level.
I teach it all the time.
Yeah, we seem to teach that play a lot, and it's a fantastic play. And it has similar concepts with the idea of the fairy world, themes of fate and transformation. And I think students generally receive that Shakespeare play very well, too. I think they're very engaged with it most of the time. And so teaching this type of story through a narrative instead of a play might be refreshing for the classroom. And discussing narrative choices between the film and the text could be a great point in class discussion or even for essay assignments. I agree with Stephen, though, in that it is incredibly difficult to cover any novel-length book in an undergraduate-level course or a high school class. It would take weeks to cover both the novel and the film. It's a lot of days that we have in the semester, and let alone covering two. I mean, you couldn't cover another novel. It's impossible to do more than one.
No, in my comp class, we're watching the documentary Muscle Shoals. It's awesome. One of our units, and they're just assigned. It's streaming for free. So that's their reading, quote unquote. Right. I can't show it in class, but you got to go watch it anyway.
Right.
So I might do that. That would, if Stardust, if we could find that streaming, yeah, or get the library to license it so that we, yeah, could do that.
I think that'd be the only way that we'd have time. And so going into scholarship, when researching for My Close Read, I noticed that there seems to be more current scholarship with the text regarding fantasy cinema instead of the written text. I definitely think there are multiple avenues for new scholarship and deepening ideas on past scholarship with the novel, especially with new literary theories emerging within the past decade and a renewal of the fantasy genre in cinema right now. I feel like, you know, post-COVID cinema, we're getting so much fantasy and science fiction now that...
Yeah, there's a lot.
There are new reviews, new
Rings
critiques.
Rings of Power.
Yeah, all the AI movies.
All those, Game of Thrones... You know, it's come about since a lot of the scholarship. I did see one that was an eco-feminist read.
Yes.
Didn't have time to look into it, but that seemed very interesting.
I think you could do a fair...
Makes sense with a
eco
star.
...eco-criticism on...
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe that's something you want to do. I don't have the time for it, which is exactly what I'm going to say, right? There's plenty in both the film and the book to delve into it, but it's not going to be me. I'm too busy. A cursory search of peer-reviewed articles, like I said, showed a respectable handful, especially for the book, but a few for the film. And that does make sense since the book is, what, 26 years old now? And I'm also over here shaking my head that 1998 was 26 years ago because to me it was, what, 2-3 years ago? And you weren't even on the planet at this point. God, I'm getting old. I need to consume A Star's Heart.
Oh, no. Don't put that on your goals list.
All right, we'll move into our WTF moment.
Okay. I am not judging the witches here, I promise. Okay, they're some of my favorites in the film, just aesthetically and through dialogue. But in the film, when our queen witch rips off her wig of cloth, I was like, whoa. Like, it was so abrupt. It was just so fast. And I didn't even realize what it was until she took it off. And her hair was going everywhere. You know, like the little fuzz was just...
It's a striking visual.
It was a very, very striking visual. And so similarly, a moment of shock for me, I guess, was when Victoria's, just her whole behavior in the film at the picnic scene within the first hour of the film, when her and Tristan are out at the picnic, she casually mentions how the picnic must have cost Tristan, like, all his money.
Yeah, that champagne's expensive.
Yes, and then continues to eat and drink, just, like, laughingly makes that comment. And granted...
She's even going to leave before she finishes the champagne, isn't she?
Yes.
He's like, no, at least drink the rest of the bottle. I spent my life savings on this and opened it.
Yes. And he insists, so I understand she has to stay. He does insist, but still, she knows what she wants and just continues to let him spoil her. And then she goes on and on about this other guy while they're on this date. And again, granted, it is Henry Cavill. But I'm just like... What the heck? You can't do this to a person. Like, how are you going to do that to this sweet guy that's just in love with you and take advantage of him like this?
She's not a good character.
No.
She's just not a good person.
She's just
good
beautiful.
Actress. Sienna Miller. But I don't know if I want to go full-blown WTF on this one, but the special effects leave something to be desired. I like the way the camera, you know, it so often zooms upward to this panoramic high and spreads out, like, way up into the stratosphere and sometimes to the stars itself, obviously. And then it'll zoom back down sometimes and go like high above a village and then swoop down to an alleyway and go into a window of a building or a house. That's pretty neat. But the landscape and towns do look a little artificial. And again, I'll give that a pass because it's a fairy tale. So I almost like the artificiality of that. But it's the other special effects that just really get on my nerves. Particularly the green magic energy and the green flames that Lamia conjures. There's that climactic scene where Yvain shines really bright and explodes Lamia. Those are just horrible by today's standards. And again, I get it. We've come a long way since CGI at that time. But it's just so painfully artificial now that it bothered me. Wasn't enough to pull me out of the experience. But the green screen work just didn't hold up. Also, how bad was that song at the end?
It wasn't my favorite.
I normally watch all the credits because it's fair. You know, all these people worked on it. They have mamas who are proud. Mm-hmm. So I try to watch and even see who the grip and the gaffer were. And I couldn't. I was just like, no, I've got to turn this thing off.
I'm honestly often shocked at how many films I watch where I feel like the ending song doesn't fit the theme of what I just watched.
This one definitely didn't. I think the only things on the soundtrack were like classical music. And of course, the can-can that Robert De Niro is humming along. But we do the geek out now.
I love geek out.
All right, for me, let's talk about the actors. The geek out moment I had was when I realized who Humphrey was. You've already mentioned it, but of course he's a rival for Victoria's heart. Tristan is out in front of Victoria's window and he comes up and I'm like squinting and tilting my head. I'm like, okay, he's blonde, but then I'm like, hey, holy crap, that's Henry Cavill, Superman. It was pretty crazy. That was the most striking revelation for me, but it was like a rogues gallery of actors that I'd forgotten were in this film. So I did read that when casting for this role, the studio wanted somebody big. They particularly wanted Orlando Bloom. And the director, Matthew Vaughn, wanted someone who was unknown to play this role. And I'd completely forgotten this was Charlie Cox, who we now know as Daredevil in both that Netflix series, and he's popped up in a few others, Spider-Man, She-Hulk. Then I realized that the narrator was Ian McKellen. I knew that, but I think I forgot I knew that. That was pretty neat. His voice. Mm-hmm. I always love to hear him talk. You've got Rupert Everett as Secundus in a pretty small role. Mark Williams, the humanized Billy Goat. Most of you will recognize him as Arthur Weasley from the Harry Potter films. There's a cameo by Ricky Gervais, Ferdy the Fencer. By the way, he ad-libbed most of his lines, including that one about the two-headed dog.
Oh, wow.
You can watch the front and back door. And then Peter O'Toole, Lawrence of Arabia?
Yeah.
That was pretty impressive. And there's a whole lineup of others, Kate McGowan, Melanie Hill, Jason Fleming. For the Anglophiles, or those with a subscription to the BBC channel on Prime, that's probably redundant, you'll definitely recognize them. They've been in a dozen or more TV shows, made-for-TV movies on British television, and I think all of them have been on Coronation Street at some time or another. But then again, is there a British actor in the last 50 years who hasn't been on Coronation Street?
Good question.
I mean, you and I have both literally broken bread with people who've been on Coronation Street every time the actors come from London. I'm like, let me guess, you had a small role on Coronation Street. You can only run, 60 years or so as a soap opera without having amassed quite a bit of a list on IMDb of actors and casts.
Great success for them. That's a long time.
More power to them. I can't stand that show. I do love British TV, but not that one.
And I guess I'm kind of a Debbie Downer this time on Geek Out because I didn't have a specific Geek Out moment. I do attribute that largely to how much I enjoyed all of it, though. I really, truly did. But I do geek out literally any time Michelle Pfeiffer does anything in a film.
She's wonderful.
I mean, she's even the fairy queen in A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah, right? You just mentioned it.
That we mentioned earlier.
Titania.
Yeah. And she's Catwoman. So, yeah.
The only Catwoman I will recognize. My apologies to Halle Berry,
good.
Who I love, but...
And if you can be a fairy queen and a superhero vigilante, you're pretty awesome. You know, you have my vote. I just really, really love her performances.
She's wonderful.
I think her facial acting is unreal. I believe her in everything she does.
And I'm so much older than you. Fabulous Fabulous Baker Boys?
Yes.
Oh, you know it. Good. That's right. You're an old soul. You may
I
be
am.
Young, but deep down you're like 60.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the cast in general was just really, really well done. Speaking of casting in general, I mentioned Orlando Bloom. Before the role was given to Claire Danes, Anne Hathaway, Scarlett Johansson, and Jessica Alba all turned down the role of Yvain. And also Sarah Michelle Gellar, who we've geeked over before as her great talent. But she turned it down because so many of the filming locations were in the UK and Iceland, and she didn't want to spend that much time away from Freddie Prinze Jr. I get it. She's a family person.
Yeah.
I just, like we said, and I know what you did last summer, I just think of what we missed, perhaps, that she could have done.
Larger, you know, big, big respect for her.
Absolutely.
And all of her decisions. I do think, you know, I think every actor and actress in this film was amazing. I do think that she would have done a fantastic job. I just think, you know, she's really good, and I can't imagine a role that I would be disappointed with her being in.
I don't know about the British accent. I've never heard her do that.
Ah.
Claire Danes did a good one.
Yes.
You know, on my other podcast, Shelf Criticism, I talked about Gwyneth Paltrow doing her British accent, and Claire Danes is very similar. They probably had the same vocal coach.
Ah.
But, again, I'm not British, but I do watch a lot of British TV. I would not have gone, yeah, there's a Yankee trying to do a British accent. It didn't strike me as that at all. I also didn't realize Charlie Cox was British, but yeah.
There are a few actors that do American accents that I don't realize are British.
It usually works the other way really well. It's just when the Americans try to do it. You know,
right.
Need we mention Keanu Reeves and Dracula?
Aw.
Good film, but.
Very good film.
He's not Jonathan Harker. I guess we ought to wrap this thing up, huh? We're getting close to the hour mark.
We are, and yeah, there are so many things we could talk about. I mean, so many little nuances and just symbols and images that pop up in both the book and the film.
We didn't talk about the illustrations.
We didn't. About the this graphic.
Originally a serial published by DC Comics, and it was the novel, but it basically had illustrations interspersed within it. And that has been republished. I actually have a copy of it. It's a Kindle version.
Highly recommend if you're going to read this.
Yeah, beautiful artwork.
Yes.
It does make me wonder, though, because it was published kind of serially. You know, I think there were four different publications of it. I do wonder if some of those lost narrative threads maybe were part of that.
Maybe.
Because there were, from what I remember, there's like a good bit. It's not just like one every month. It was like a good bit of time in between each one of them.
That's an interesting thing.
Gives you time to gauge the public's feedback, or maybe if you've not written it, to forget some of the things. I know Neil Gaiman's a sharp guy, but who knows? I don't know if that's the case or not, but.
It's still a very interesting
thought. It is a lot like when I teach William Blake. You know, I tell my students, we shouldn't just read the poems. We need to look at his illustrations. And, mm-hmm. and I think you do yourself a disservice by not looking at both.
I agree with like Alice in Wonderland even.
Yeah.
And people think I'm referring to the children's book, you know, sometimes when I say that. But no, Lewis Carroll has illustrations
Absolutely.
In Alice in Wonderland that are very, very good. And there are just a bunch of concepts that, you know, I talked a little bit about some cliches being in the movie earlier, but there are some things that I have never seen before, like traveling by candle. I just think that is so neat.
That's cool.
I think that is such a cool idea.
Harry Potter. Yeah, that does come from a 19th century nursery rhyme, actually. I'm not going to sing it, but what is it? How many miles to Babylon? 70. Can I get there by candlelight? Yes, and back again.
I just love it. I like how they took it so literally.
Not bubbling.
And then it runs out and you don't have it anymore. I think that is so cool too. Like there's a time frame on how often you can do this.
And didn't he, in the book, he like smashed the wax back together before he escaped?
Yes.
She's not Lami in the book, but the witch.
Because in the book he does run out of it.
Right.
He doesn't have it at the end.
He just kind of has to smush it together and that's why they get stuck on the clouds.
And in the film he has this giant new candle. To use.
Right. That the strange little hairy man plot device gives
Mr.
him.
Mr. Plot Device gave him.
Any other notes, sir?
No, I mean, I could talk about it all day.
If this were shelf criticism, what shelf would you put it on?
Okay, it's hard for me to separate genre here. Definitely second shelf.
I would agree.
Yeah. I think I have to leave the first. I'm going to go with second.
Yeah, it's not top shelf.
Yeah.
They're definitely flaws. The CGI, if nothing else. But I don't know. It's probably a mid-shelf, but I like it so much my personal opinion's got to do something. So I'd put it on second as well. Good, because I have it on DVD. So this is officially a podcast for shelf criticism, too.
I just enjoyed it so much. I just really did. I think it's such a intriguing, feel-good movie.
That's good. I'm going to upload this to shelf criticism, too, then.
Promo.
No, I'm dead serious because
I
missed last week. I've been busy, so... Maybe this can just take the place.
Absolutely.
Do double duty. Oh, speaking of podcasts. So, fun question somebody asked me a few weeks ago. What's the right day to start celebrating, decorating, getting into the Halloween spirit?
Honestly, any day. If you want to decorate for fall and Halloween in April, go for it. Like, no judgment here.
Okay. For me, it's November 1st. Every day is Halloween. But for those of you who are a bit more normal than I am, the start of October is at least fair, right?
Yeah, in a traditional view, I would say October 1st makes logical sense, right? Because September has the first day of fall, and all of October is really taken with Halloween events. But it's also summer weather in Alabama for basically 7 months.
Oh, yeah. It's still hot.
So sometimes it's hard to remember that it's October.
But either way, we'd be remiss if we didn't celebrate the season properly. Even though Real Lit has leaned quite a bit into the spooky and macabre and, well, zombie strippers, whatever the heck that is, we couldn't let the spookiest holiday pass without some proper spine-tingling fare, right?
That is absolutely right. And that's why next episode, we're diving into the 1983 novel by Susan Hill and the 2012 film starring Harry Potter. just kidding. Daniel Radcliffe?
That's his name.
Daniel Radcliffe, Mr. Harry Potter, in The Woman in Black.
Absolutely. This is his first film after the Harry Potter films.
And good for him.
Yeah, the film's currently streaming on Paramount Plus and Pluto TV if you want to revisit it. And if you do, send us your questions, comments, or spooky thoughts. You can reach us at reallit@reallitpodcast.com. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at reallitpodcast. And remember, that's R-E-E-L, as in a film reel.
And also make sure that you go check out Steven's podcast, Shelf Criticism.
What's that?
Shelf Criticism. Steven's podcast. I got a lot of really great lineups for October in particular.
Yes, I do. I'm also celebrating the spooky season.
Of course.
Trying to go it a little bit sideways. I've got an animal attack in there because I'm me.
You need it. Need it in there.
Rogue, lions, and also a fox. That's
Megan. Not the rats.
It's Megan Fox. No, not Deadly Eyes. I wish I could get a copy of that. Mirrors, Kiefer Sutherland. I'm going to do Van Helsing, which I really love. It's not so much scary as just flat out hilarious, but I always watch that every Halloween. It's just one of those traditions. And also Lords of Salem. Going full-blown Rob Zombie, make you feel very uncomfortable type of film. So looking forward to that. And also, we have some other big news. I've been teasing this on Shelf Criticism a couple of weeks, but go ahead and just get it out there.
Get it out there.
All right. If I had, you know the answer to this now, but if I had to ask you before you knew, how much money did the lowest grossing domestic film of all time make?
I believe when you asked me, my first guess was like $10,000.
Yeah, definitely in the thousands, right? Yeah. Try 30. Not 30,000. 30.
$30.
Not to mention the director reimbursed two of the attendees tickets. So technically netted $20. And if you're thinking, yeah, this is just a bad student film that somebody made and somehow managed to get distributed to qualify for this. No. Katherine Heigl. Ever heard of her? Grey's Anatomy. She's in it. Tom Sizemore. It's actually a film. And when I came across this article, I was like, oh, I got to watch this. Very hard to find. But I'm like, we got to do a podcast. We got to watch this film.
Lowest grossing film of all time.
A film that made $30. We've got to talk about it, right? So very soon, what is it, November, we're going to be looking into this?
Yes.
Yeah, you, me, and?
Reagan.
Yes, that name that we get mentioned at the end of every episode. Our executive producer will be joining us on that one as well.
The amazing Reagan Babb.
And I guess that's a wrap.
Yes, it is. Well, listeners, please remember that Real Lit is an Owls of Palace production. Our executive producer is Reagan Babb.
Yay.
Woo! And our theme music is Honor and Sword by Zakhar Vahala. For Real Lit, we're your hosts, Mackenzie and Steven. Until next time, keep both the reels and the pages turning.
I do think it could make for an interesting. Why can I not say the word interesting?